Funding for the Think Podcast comes from Fort Worth ISD, striving to inspire young minds with academic and extracurricular programs that provide skills and experiences to help students flourish and achieve their dreams. Registration details at fwisd.org/register.
When you consider the list of our most pressing social problems, disparate health outcomes, crime and police violence, school achievement gaps, and economic inequality, you discover that all these challenges have a surprising factor in common. Surprising because it's a problem many Americans assumed we corrected long ago. It's housing segregation. It's true that the Fair Housing Act unequivocally outlawed practices that bar people of any race or background moving wherever they like way back in 1968. But more than half a century later, the legacy of earlier unfair policies is unmistakable, and it is still harming millions of people. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The problems are most concentrated among lower-income people of color. But middle-class Black Americans are still much more likely to live in low-income neighborhoods than their white peers earning similar salaries. As my guest will explain, there are a number of reasons for this, but choice is not one of them. Leah Rothstein has more than two decades of experience as a consultant to affordable housing developers and local governments and as a community and union organizer. Her book, written with her father, Richard Rothstein, is called Just Action: How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. Leah, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this idea that residential segregation is a key contributor to many of our worst social problems, this, I think, takes people by surprise on multiple levels. First is the fact that most Americans know that mandated segregation has been illegal for decades. Why wasn't a change in the law enough to correct the problem?
Well, like you mentioned in the intro, it's not just about current discrimination. It's about the legacies of the discriminatory policies of the past, the unconstitutional policies of our government. So to give an example, when the federal government in the 40s decided to suburbanize the country by subsidizing suburbs across the country in a, you know, at a time when most people did not live in suburbs, but they lived in urban areas, the Federal Housing Administration subsidized suburban developments and required that those suburban homes only be sold to white homebuyers, specifically prohibited African Americans from buying these homes. Now, those homes at the time, the development was not only subsidized by the federal government, but the home buyers were also subsidized. You know, if they were veterans, they could get a no down payment mortgage from the Veterans Administration. If not, they could get a low interest mortgage from the Federal Housing Administration. And they bought homes that were affordable to working class families of any race at the time, about $100,000 in today's money. Now today, now that we have laws on the books that say that we can't discriminate in selling those homes, you know, we can't discriminate by race, but those homes no longer cost $100,000. They cost $200,000, $300,000, $500,000, in some places over $1 million. And so a family that doesn't have the intergenerational wealth that was built by owning a home when it was affordable and then increased exponentially in value over the years. So African Americans who are prohibited from building wealth that way can't afford to buy into these suburban developments now. So addressing and outlawing discrimination is important, but we can't, you know, change the living patterns we see today without also addressing the disparities that exist because of past government policies.
And housing today is generally more expensive for Black residents of segregated neighborhoods than for their white peers, whether they buy that housing or rent it. What's going on there?
Well, yeah. So one example, one reason for this is the property tax assessment system. So in metropolitan areas all across the country, African-American homebuyers pay a higher rate of property tax relative to the value of their home than white homeowners. And there's many reasons for this. It's how the property tax assessment system works, where homes are assessed for a value that their tax rate is applied to. Those reassessments don't happen very often. So when the reassessment doesn't happen, white homes appreciate faster than homes in African-American neighborhoods. And their assessed value doesn't change as fast. So white homeowners are paying basically a tax rate applied to a lower value, a value that's farther lower than their home's actual market value than African Americans are. So those African American home buyers, they buy homes that are maybe less expensive, but over time they're paying more and more in property taxes relative to the value of their home. So their home costs continue to rise relative to white homeowners, where their property taxes rise less quickly relative to their home values. So this is an example of a policy, and there's many of them, and we describe them in Just Action. It's a policy that's race neutral on its face. It doesn't have a racially discriminatory intent, but it is racially discriminatory in effect. African American home buyers, homeowners across the country pay a property tax rate that's higher than their white home owning peers in the same cities.
These days, Leah, lots of people who care about justice are concerned about the effects of implicit bias, these negative views we might hold kind of under the surface about other groups, even if we don't want to embrace prejudice. You don't deny that implicit bias can be a problem. You also don't think it can be eliminated, so it's maybe not the best target here.
Well, it's a good target, but it's not a place to start necessarily. Mm-hmm. We need to address our implicit biases so we can work together with people of other races, which is essential to making the change that we think is necessary around these issues. We advocate for starting biracial, multi-ethnic groups in our own communities to begin to address these issues locally and to advocate for local policy change. Now, to do that, we do need to address our implicit biases so that we can have social connections and good working relationships with people of other races. But that is not our end goal. Our end goal is creating policy change and structural change that will address these disparities and address the inequalities we see in our society. And we do believe that once we address those inequalities, our implicit biases will change. You know, there's a reason we have, so the government policies that relegated African Americans to live in, in overcrowded urban areas where they paid more for their rental units and they had to double or triple up in their homes in order to make rent. Their neighborhoods were less serviced by public services like trash collectors. So the neighborhoods looked, you know, less well kept. And so that developed an implicit bias in whites who didn't understand the structural forces behind making those neighborhoods what they are. And they developed an implicit bias that African Americans like to live, you know, socialize on the street, live in crowded homes and you know, in neighborhoods that aren't clean. But they didn't understand the reasons behind it. And those structural reasons created the implicit bias. So if we change those structures and change how we live amongst each other, our biases and our beliefs about each other will change as well.
You say that when the Supreme Court rejects things like affirmative action or efforts to promote desegregation, it does so by ignoring the history of how the U.S. came to be segregated in the first place, which is to say, I guess the court broadly assumes that de facto segregation reflects personal choice rather than historical precedent.
Yeah, there is a myth throughout our country, accepted by the Supreme Court, that we are segregated by race because of personal choice or by accident or because of economics, that, you know, race and economics track to each other and we live in neighborhoods with people of similar socioeconomic status. So it's sort of an accident that we live in neighborhoods where people are the same race as us. You know, we've believed that for a long time. It has been accepted throughout our country for a long time. And then my father wrote The Color of Law in 2017 that took issue with that myth, the de facto segregation myth, and really demolished it by showing policy after policy from all levels of government, from local, state, and federal government that intentionally and explicitly created racially segregated communities, that it was no accident. It wasn't personal choice. You know, people weren't allowed the choice in where to live when whites were permitted to live in some areas and African Americans were permitted to live in others. So despite the fact that the Supreme Court still ascribes to this myth, I think The Color of Law and its wide readership has started to, you know, debunk that myth, and it has less currency. And that's why we're talking about these issues so much more today, I believe.
I don't normally endorse books, but it is a brilliant one, and I had the opportunity to speak with your father when it was recently published. I would highly recommend anyone enjoying this conversation also add The Color of Law to their reading list along with Just Action. What kinds of court rulings then, Leah, might actually cause U.S. neighborhoods to expand racial diversity?
Well, we focus on what we can do locally in our own communities. And we understand that litigation and court action has, you know, made advances in racial justice in the past, but alone it won't do enough. And so what we need to do is start to enact changes locally that address these issues that are race-conscious remedies, because as we say, race-conscious crimes like the ones that created segregated communities require race-conscious remedies. And so we need to create remedies, you know, subsidies for African Americans to buy into homes and neighborhoods where they were once prohibited from purchasing homes. That's one example. Addressing the disparities in property tax assessment system, for example, protecting renters from displacement when a neighborhood gentrifies, and ensuring that those African-American neighborhoods where people are being displaced, that those residents are given preferences to housing that's built in that neighbor, in those neighborhoods. So these are the kinds of local changes that may eventually inspire legal action, because it is not what we think the Supreme Court will support in terms of race conscious and race specific remedies. But we need to start by enacting change first and having the courage to defy what the Supreme Court may or may not support. And that is actually how we make advances in racial justice and racial equity. That's how we always have and how we will now.
I have to say, I was intrigued, but also, frankly, surprised by this argument that it's time we stop deferring to Supreme Court rulings over what is constitutional, at least in this sphere. What does it look like? What would it take to do that?
Well, it would take programs that address these race-specific crimes. So, for example, what I described about the, you know, suburbanization of the country and white generational wealth that was allowed to accumulate because of federal government programs that subsidized white home ownership in the mid-20th century and prohibited African Americans from doing the same. So we need to address that disparity in wealth. Currently, African American average household wealth is 5% of white household wealth, and that's due almost entirely to these policies that allowed whites to purchase homes when they were affordable and then benefit from the accumulation in value of those homes, and prohibited African Americans from doing so. So a program to address that disparity would be a down payment assistance grant program that's targeted to African Americans who were prohibited from home ownership in these communities. And so that race specific remedy is what's needed to address that disparity, for example. That's one example, and our book is filled with many of them.
And if Congress were to put a program like this in place, it actually has the power to declare any particular topic off limits to Supreme Court review?
It does. I don't believe it has ever used that power, but it does have that power. And I'll just add that, you know, the Supreme Court, we, in the field of racial justice, we tend to defer to the Supreme Court in a way that other activists on other issues haven't, especially these days. So if we think about the abortion debate, you know, when Roe v. Wade was the law of the land, abortion opponents defied it by passing laws restricting abortion all across the country. And then that eventually led to Supreme Court to change its mind about abortion. And now abortion proponents are defying the Dobbs decision by providing abortions where it's now outlawed. So we do, you know, have a sort of approach in this country of defying the Supreme Court when we think it's the right thing to do. It's what happened in the civil rights movement. You know, the people who sat in at lunch counters in the South and on buses and, you know, demonstrated for racial justice and change in that level were defying local law and Supreme Court precedent. And that's how we advanced these issues. And so that's what we need to continue to do.
Leah, it has long been a core component of the American dream for families to own their own homes. You note that buying property is indeed one way Black Americans can build wealth, but you remind us home ownership does not generate wealth for everybody at the same rates.
That's right. We think of home ownership as the ticket to accumulating wealth because that's how it's worked for white homeowners. And that's partly because of government policy that subsidized white homeowners to get into home ownership in the mid-20th century when homes were more affordable than they are today. So buying a home at a low price and then having it accumulate in value for decades and decades is a ticket to accumulating wealth. But African Americans were prohibited from buying homes in the same way at that time. And now that, you know, we no longer allow the discrimination in the sale and rental of housing, we still see that homes in white neighborhoods accumulate at a faster rate than homes in African American neighborhoods. And homes in African American neighborhoods are taxed at a higher rate relative to homes in white neighborhoods compared to their market value. And so there's a lot of reasons why home ownership for African Americans isn't the same ticket to building wealth as it has been for whites. Now, it's not to say that it's not an important piece of, you know, of building some wealth. And, you know, home ownership is still something to strive for. It allows for more stability. People who own their homes are more invested in their communities. It's still a goal that we believe we should work towards, but we temper that by saying that it's not the end all and be all of goals we should be striving for to address segregation and housing inequality. It's one of many, but not the magic bullet.
You remind us here of a fact I think a lot of us have forgotten, which is that public housing in this country was originally set up for families who didn't necessarily require any kind of subsidy. How did it happen that these places got converted so that they really only serve people in the most dire financial circumstances?
Yeah, public housing began in the 1930s in the Great Depression for working families, not for the many, many Americans who were unemployed in the Great Depression, but for the many working families who couldn't find housing because no housing was being built and there was a housing shortage. So public housing was built to house those families, and it was built separately, separate buildings, separate developments for whites and for African Americans. So creating segregation in urban areas where it didn't already exist. But to your point, they were not subsidized. They were built for working families who could afford the rent there. And then as it happened that, you know, the Great Depression ended and working families could then move out of these housing developments. The federal government subsidized the suburbanization of the country for whites. So then they could move out of these public housing projects and into single family homes outside of urban areas subsidized by the federal government. And then who was left in these public housing projects were more and more poor people who were underemployed or unemployed, and they came to be what we now see and think public housing has always been, which is areas of concentrated poverty, poorly maintained buildings, you know, places of high crime. But that's not how they started. It's not how it's always been.
Concentrated poverty is detrimental to a neighborhood that mixed incomes within a neighborhood are not.
Yeah, so when we concentrate people, poor people in one neighborhood, we're concentrating a lot of disadvantage in one place. And we lack people in that neighborhood who have sort of the resources and political influence to bring more services and more resources to that neighborhood. And areas of concentrated poverty, because they lack resources and lack political influence, tend to be areas that are located, for example, near industry, near polluting factories, near highways with trucks that are polluting the air. So people in those neighborhoods suffer more from asthma, from lead poisoning because the buildings are older and have lead paint. They have worse health outcomes. So children who grow up in segregated African-American neighborhoods, they grow up to have higher cancer rates and higher rates of cardiovascular disease and lower life expectancies than whites, even poor whites who grow up in poor white neighborhoods. And that's because these areas of concentrated poverty also lack resources. So when we're talking about segregation, racial segregation, we're not just talking about the segregation of people where some people live here and some people live here and other than, you know, the race of the people, the areas are the same. When segregation was created for whites to live in some areas and African Americans to live in others, We also the government also segregated resources between those areas. So white areas were given more resources. African American neighborhoods were divested in resources. So less well-resourced public schools, no open space, like I said, more pollution, fewer, you know, retail stores and grocery stores and bank branches. So then you're concentrated in these areas with few resources, and it's hard to get out of them. And it affects people who live in those areas, their life outcomes. And like I said, health, but also income and educational outcomes. And so we argue for creating communities that are mixed income, and that will help those lower income families have access to neighborhoods that are better resourced, you know, schools that are better resourced, more open space, healthier air. And that will only happen if we begin to mix up our neighborhoods and provide a range of income ranges of the people who live there.
Leah, what doesn't seem to work to sort of not just fix people's financial disparities, but also get people to get along better with their neighbors and sort of understand each other across racial groups, is putting a handful of very low income residents into a very wealthy neighborhood. Why does it work better when policies bring together people who are relatively similar in terms of social status, but may have different racial identities?
Yeah, what you're referring to is often we hear about mixed income housing developments, and those developments often have units that are subsidized through federal financing programs for very low income families and then market rate units. So they mix the poorest and the most affluent together in one building. And that often doesn't lead to, you know, beneficial social contact. They're just too different culturally and, you know, economically. And so what we need, truly mixed income developments, will include low income units and lower income families, middle income, and market rate or higher income. And that's because those middle income families are more likely to be able to bridge the gap between those disparate ends and create more social contact that is beneficial and that sort of bridges the divides that exist between people of very disparate economic and social situations.
This is so interesting. You say in the book, single family zoning may be the most powerful policy perpetuating racial inequality. How does that happen?
Yeah, so zoning is what we use as local jurisdictions to determine how we use the land in our jurisdiction. So the zoning code will say we can put industrial uses in this part of town, commercial uses in this part of town, residential uses in this part of town. And then it determines what kind of residences can be built where. So in some places, only single family homes, in some places, multifamily buildings. Now, it used to be in the early 1900s, and before that, that cities could zone areas of their city by race. They could use racial zoning. So whites can live in this part of town, African Americans in this part of town. Now that became illegal in the early 1900s, but what replaced that was single family only zoning. So by saying that in this area of town, we can only build one house per lot, that ensures that housing in that area will remain expensive by basically capping the number of housing units that can be built there. And that, you know, caps the amount of supply. So as demand increases, prices of those houses will go up. And for, you know, all of the reasons that we've been talking about, African Americans are less likely to have the same kind of wealth that white families have. And so by ensuring that house prices stay high, you're ensuring that African Americans are less likely to live in those communities. So now we are in a situation where 75% of residentially zoned land in the country is zoned to only allow single family homes on a lot. And so this is the strongest form of maintaining segregation that we have in these communities. And so a lot of local jurisdictions and states are taking on this issue and changing the laws to not allow single family only zoning, to allow, you know, in an area that used to only allow one house per lot, now maybe a duplex or a triplex or a fiveplex could be on that lot. And by allowing that, you can allow more housing in the community. So increasing supply may bring down prices, but also allow a more diverse type of housing in that community. So whereas once we could only have one house on, you know, 1 acre. Now we can have several homes. And so there's more diversity of housing options, and that can create a more diverse residence in those housing units and in those communities. But we argue that changing single family only zoning is an essential step towards desegregating our communities, but it's not the only step. On top of that, we then need preferences for African Americans to be able to access those units. Because even as there are more units in a community and they may be less expensive than they once were, it's still likely that white households will outbid African Americans for those units because they have more intergenerational wealth and average higher incomes. And so if we want to use ending single family only zoning as a tool for desegregating exclusive suburbs, for example, we also need to add some preferences to the units that are built.
Leah, plenty of people support the idea of constructing more affordable housing until somebody says, great, we're going to put that affordable housing in your neighborhood. What can work to relieve the problem of resistance to affordable housing, especially in neighborhoods that are currently majority white?
I think we'd be naive to think that we will ever not face resistance to these kinds of changes. It's just so ingrained in so many people that, you know, changing a neighborhood by allowing affordable housing is detrimental to their housing values or their quality of life. So we won't convince all of those people who are opposed to changing their neighborhoods in this way to not be opposed. But what we believe is that just as there's a lot of opposition to this, there's also a lot of support, and there's more support than we maybe think. The opposers that we're talking about, we often call them NIMBYs, not in my backyard. They're people who say they support affordable housing in general until it's proposed in their neighborhood. So those NIMBYs are very loud, they're vocal. They show up at city council meetings and planning meetings. They make it very difficult to approve of these kinds of affordable housing developments. But we give many examples in our book and in a Substack column that we're continuing to write about these issues of exclusive neighborhoods, predominantly white, where people just started talking to their neighbors and going door to door to talk about these issues, and found that there was more support for approving affordable housing than there were NIMBYs. And it just takes finding them and organizing them and getting on the same sort of page around the values that they have for their community, and then finding those supporters and showing up just as often as NIMBYs do to the local city council meetings and planning commission meetings. So it's not that we're ever going to probably end the opposition, but we can meet it with the support that we actually have in our communities and by building that support and organizing.
So you've identified in this conversation and certainly in the book a lot of challenges to doing this, but these challenges are not insurmountable. Will you tell us about Cleveland Heights, Ohio, which in 1970 had a black population of 1% and today has a black population of 40%?
Yeah, so Cleveland Heights, along with, we also talk about Oak Park, Illinois outside of Chicago, and West Mount Airy outside of Philadelphia. These are three examples of communities that were all white and started to diversify and decided to intentionally not allow what was happening in other communities at the time, which was when they started to diversify, all the whites left and they became sort of a flipped, resegregated all African American neighborhood. And the whites who lived there had to, you know, ended up leaving their communities and all of their cultural ties and social ties that they had developed living there for a long time. And so these white residents decided they wanted to do something different. And they organized, they talked to their neighbors, they dispelled the fears that people had about living in integrated communities. They countered the white flight that happened at the time wasn't just sort of a naturally occurring phenomenon. It was incited by realtors. And so in Cleveland Heights and these other communities, they organized to prevent realtors from inciting white flight. They, for example, prohibited for sale signs on homes, because that's one way that realtors incited fear amongst white residents or homeowners, by putting up a lot of for sale signs around a community. And so then the white homeowners started to be afraid that their community, something bad was happening, everybody was selling. So they would sell out of fear at low prices, and the community would flip to become a resegregated community. So they outlawed for sale signs. They built, social networks and local community institutions that promoted integrated neighborhoods, built social relationships. They helped African-American homebuyers ensure that they weren't being discriminated against by realtors by providing white escorts to them when they went to look at homes. So they really methodically addressed all of the ways that communities like theirs would be resegregated when they started to diversify. And they ended up creating an integrated, diverse community and maintained that diversity for decades. And so now in Cleveland Heights and in these other communities, they now have a racial diversity that's, you know, equal to the surrounding area, which is unique because often that doesn't happen without intentional effort. And we provided those examples to show that, yeah, there's opposition, there's challenges, it feels overwhelming and impossible, but it's not. There are success stories from across the country of doing this. And we hope to provide some hope and inspiration to people wanting to address these issues in their own communities, that it is being done elsewhere, that people are working on these issues everywhere and having some success.
Leah Rothstein is a consultant to affordable housing developers and local governments. Her book, written with Richard Rothstein, is called Just Action: How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. Leah, thank you so much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.